Hello, Matthias.
Hello. I think Dorrit's expecting a call from me. My name's John Holton from...
Expecting a phone call from you?
Yeah, I am. I'll take it
here. Okay, 1 second. Hello.
Hello.
I'm yours.
Great.
I'm all yours. Now, tell me, what is this for? Tell me what you need to know. Tell me what you want to know.
Well, I'd love to know, I mean, if you've got like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'd love to know, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, I'd love to know about, well, first of all, Samar, your dog that passed away.
My darling dog. Well, sadly, he's no longer alive, but hopefully he will come back in heaven on earth, which is, or he is, he has come back. He's now 3 days of age.
Wow.
And Viagen have cloned him.
John?
Yes?
Who is this on the phone?
So that was me talking to Dorrit Museev, the former First Lady of Iceland. Dorrit is a jewelry designer. She's also an editor and a businesswoman. Originally, she's from Israel, but we have her on the show here because she's cloned her dog, Samur.
Wow.
Yeah. And since, you know, we wanted to always do an episode on cloning...
Aw, you gave it away.
I had this slightly frantic phone call with her. Because, you know, and this was 3 years ago, so it's been a long time in the works, this episode.
Oh, wow. Yeah, let's rewind that a bit and listen to the rest of that.
Slightly too toxic lunch, but...
Okay, I got you. That sounds good, or maybe bad, I don't know. But so, you, how long did you have the dog, the first incarnation?
It took 12 years.
Okay, and you traveled together and lived together in Iceland, or did he?
Yes, he did not travel out of Iceland because Iceland has quarantine laws.
Oh, really?
But he traveled with me everywhere in Iceland and was the love of my life.
Oh, and so you knew in advance that he was sick, or was it a...
No, the strange thing is I did not know in advance. He didn't show any signs of sickness at all. No, he was cloned long before he died. He was very fortunately cloned. As soon as I found out that this was available to me.
Would you consider that the same dog?
No, of course, it's two different dogs. But they were going to be, one dog was 12 years old, the other dog would have been a puppy. Viagen did a great job. They picked up the cells in a frozen box, they went to America. And then we had two false starts, but the third one looks like succeeded brilliantly.
Okay, excellent. So then that came to term, you had a birth 3 days ago?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. So then what happens next?
Well, what happens next, obviously the baby has to be with his mother. Mm-hmm. And because he's an only child, he needs to immediately be sociable and be with other puppies.
And would the other dogs that he's feeding with be cloned? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, they're all being cloned. That's what Viagen does. They clone dogs.
And so you don't get to see him for some time?
Well, I can go and visit him, okay. Not right now, because they want him to be in a sterile environment as possible. But once he's 8 weeks, I will collect him, or they will bring him to me, depending on my choice.
And then he'll be just as strong and healthy as any other dog.
Well, we hope so.
Right.
We hope so. I mean, my next thing is, I'm actually going to have another one cloned, but I'm going to try and attempt to get the cancerous gene out of him.
Oh, wow.
And this will, of course, help humanity as a whole.
Yeah.
That's why I find it so difficult to understand people who are criticizing it. It's unethical. It's probably one of the most ethical things I could be doing. Tell me, where are you based?
Okay, so first of all, that was my favorite phone call ever. She seems amazing.
I'm not like the best on phone calls, and it was a bit intimidating. And yeah, it is. It's pretty wild, you know, cloning your dog.
Yeah, definitely. So in this episode, we want to find out more about cloning, the actual process, the future of cloning, but also where we're at in the present moment when it comes to cloning and gene editing technology.
Yes, the CRISPR technology.
It always makes me hungry when I hear CRISPR.
That's because you've spent too long in the UK now and you're into crisps, not chips.
No, French fries.
Yes, so chips or French fries.
I say French fries, but I do say crisps, which is shameful. But I've just noticed that if I say chips in the UK, what I get is French fries. So you kind of like have to say crisps.
Right. Yes, of course you do.
But I've actually also started saying trousers.
Anyway, now I'm hungry because of all this crisp talk. This is episode 5. I cloned my dog. I cloned my dog.
See what we did there?
Lifecycle, a podcast about the future of humanity.
So, John, tell me more about Dorrit Museev and how she became a cloned dog owner.
Right, so Dorit decided to clone her dog Salmer back in 2019 after he died sadly of cancer. And as you heard her say, you know, he was the big love of her life. And it makes sense, I guess, you know, if you lose a pet or anybody who's the big love of your life, you know, you'd want to be able to, you know, bring them back. This is a kind of age-old human instinct, right? Or it's a dream, at least, of humanity.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense, even though I would say the method is unconventional. She mentioned Viagen cloned him. What's Viagen?
Yeah, it's quite literally a company that clones pet animals. It's a service that, you know...
They provide. But what kind of animals do they clone?
Well, the last time I checked, they offer dog and cat cloning services, and a dog costs just $50,000 to clone, and a cat is a bit less at $35,000.
Wow, I wonder what a goldfish would cost.
Yeah, that might be a bit more affordable. Who knows? It seems like they're judging on the size there or something. I don't know. Cat owners will be like, wait a minute, my cat is definitely smarter than most people's dogs. But you can pay in two installments, so that's good news.
Okay, and so I just have so many questions, though. There's just something about cloning that's kind of creepy.
Mm.
But I think that's also because, honestly, the process, to me at least, has always been mysterious. I think most of us remember Dolly the sheep, the first cloned animal ever, cloned in 1996 in Scotland. But, like, how exactly do you clone a sheep or a dog?
Viagen, conveniently enough, have a video that explains what they do when they're cloning. So let's maybe have a listen to that.
At Viagen Pets, we know lots of people have questions about genetic preservation and cloning of their beloved dog or cat. So let's meet the Anderson family and their pet, Buddy. Buddy is a smart, playful 12-year-old golden retriever. The Andersons consider Buddy to be an irreplaceable member of the family. As Buddy got older, the Andersons decided to preserve Buddy's genes. Their vet performed a small tissue biopsy, a minor procedure for Buddy, and sent the sample to Viagen for genetic preservation. We cultured new living cells from the sample, and then the cells were frozen for preservation. So the Andersons were comforted to know they had the option to clone their pet should they choose to do so. Today, the Andersons decided to clone Buddy. To begin, we'll take one of Buddy's cells and replace the nucleus of a female dog's egg. After treatment by our patented process, the egg and cell join together and the embryo starts to grow. Soon, the embryo is transferred to a surrogate mother who, after a typical gestation, will give birth to Buddy 2, Buddy's clone. None of Buddy's genes were changed, so Buddy 2 is really like Buddy's identical twin brother, just born at a later time. Buddy, too, will be as healthy as Buddy was as a puppy, and most likely will also be smart, playful, and look like Buddy as well. And with the Andersons' love, he'll grow and thrive. To learn more about dog and cat cloning, please visit us at viagenpets.com.
It all sounds really positive and so happy. Like, why wouldn't you clone your dog if you had 50 grand to spare? It's so easy. Just don't really buy into it, though. Like, I can't help but feel that there's a more sinister side to this.
I don't know. Maybe you feel that way because, you know, cloning, you know, depictions of cloning in science fiction, it does feel like that's what we're talking about. Like, it's a science fiction, even though, you know, obviously this episode shows that it's not, that it's here. But, you know, it's always been represented as something sinister. It goes really wrong. You know, think of Star Wars, Attack of the Clones, or even Jurassic Park. That's a kind of cloning.
Mm-hmm.
Scenario. Blade Runner, I guess that's also, you know, a whole kind of cloning thing. And anyway, there's lots of depictions of cloning going.
That's true. You might be right. Okay, so let's really dig into the process. In that Viagen video, what I get from that is basically you do a tissue biopsy and you use that tissue sample to culture new cells of the same being, in this case, a dog. Then you take a cell from a female dog and replace the nucleus. And the nucleus is the part of a cell. It's the bit in the middle that contains all the DNA and the genetic information. So it's like kind of like the control room of a cell. And so you strip the female dog's cell of its nucleus. So that means it's now a cell without any genetic information in it. And then the original dog cell is inserted into that egg cell, which was stripped, which is empty. And through a secretive, patented process, as they call it in the video, which most likely is an electric pulse, they fuse the two and an embryo starts growing.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, right? Like, and this is all happening in a laboratory.
Yeah.
And then from there, the rest of the process is probably, I guess, maybe a bit more familiar to most people. The embryo is transferred to the womb of a surrogate dog mother, and pregnancy and birth occur thereafter.
I thought of one thing that makes cloning less creepy.
Okay.
So twins are technically clones.
Ah, yes.
Identical twins, of course. They come from the same cell, the exact same DNA. In fact, you could even argue that identical twins are more identical to each other than clones are to their DNA donors, because twins usually share the same environment growing up, which clones do not. And twins aren't creepy, right?
No, not at all. My nieces are identical twins, and I love them very much.
They're not creepy?
No. No, they're not.
So to find out more about the scientific aspect of cloning, I went to Boston to speak to Professor Rudolf Janisch, who is a professor of biology at MIT, and he went on to explain this process of removing the nucleus in more detail.
So development occurs by, development comes from the egg, obviously from the fertilized egg, and during development, certain genes are activated in a given tissue, let's say in the liver, but they're not active in the brain. In the brain, their brain genes active, but not the liver. So this is called differential gene expression in tissues. Now, on cloning, so initially, that's now quite a while ago, one thought that differentiation is a one-way road. You go from the totipotent to a pluripotent, so embryonic cells, to differentiated cells, one way. Now, cloning really proved this to be false. Because in cloning, you take a nucleus from a differentiated cell. For example, from the mammary gland in case of Dolly. Dolly was the first cloned animal. Take the nucleus, which of course only is there to express the mammary-specific genes. For example, milk production, whatever. You put this in an egg from whose own nucleus was removed. And now the amazing thing happens that the egg can what we call reprogram this differentiated nucleus, a nucleus coming from a differentiated cell, which only makes milk appropriate genes, to something which is embryonic. So it turns off those genes and turns on the embryonic genes. And when you now let this fertilized egg, or this egg which removed its own nucleus from, after transfer, when you let it develop and put it into a foster mother, you get an animal, like Dolly. So this is a pretty amazing result.
So that's so amazing, right? Janisch goes back to Dolly the sheep, and with Dolly, they used a cell from the mammary gland. So this cell's purpose was to express something specific, milk production. And when that cell was inserted into the stripped egg, the nucleus reprogrammed into turning on its embryonic genes and turning off its milk-producing genes. And basically recreated itself.
It argues that the egg is able to reprogram, to reset the genome to an embryonic state. So differentiation is not irreversible. It is reversible. It's called epigenetic regulation. So that's really was a key thing. So you can, in principle, therefore, generate identical copies of anyone by nuclear cloning. Because if you take the nucleus from a skin cell of anyone and put the nucleus into the egg, the individual you get out of this has exactly the same genetic composition as the donor. So it's an identical copy, except it's maybe 30 years younger, depending how old the donor was. So this is cloning, which of course has then, you can make identical copies of any sort. So that's the key thing. So in agriculture, this is used, for example, to make priced bulls, make them identical. So you don't, in normal reproduction, you go to meiosis where everything gets remixed. In cloning, you shortcut meiosis, which is really the recombination which occurs in before fertilization. You shortcut that and you get identical individuals. So that's the key thing of cloning.
And then we started talking about CRISPR-Cas9, which is a gene editing technology. And I guess you could say it falls under the same umbrella of topics as cloning does.
So the CRISPR was like a molecular scissor. So the CRISPR system came from bacteria, from an immune system of bacteria, which they use as defense against viruses, right? And it's a very ingenious system. So it's a molecular scissor where you can cut the DNA at a predetermined position. So you can predetermine, I want to cut this particular gene, right? So you do the CRISPR procedure and you cut this. And the point is, it is extremely efficient.
Okay.
So it's so efficient. So when we did the first experiments in mice, you can do it directly in the fertilized egg. So eggs, you can't select eggs, right? It's much, but it's maybe with the efficiency of 80%, you get the mutants. It was mind-boggling.
Janusz told me that what they used to do in the 80s was something called homologous recombination. You would go inside the genetic material and mutate a gene to create a certain disease, for example. And then you could study that disease more closely. They used this technique on mice, and they referred to them as mutant mice.
If you do the mutations via embryonic stem cells, it takes you, let's say, 1 to 2 years to come to the mouse because of all the manipulations involved. With CRISPR, it is 3 weeks. It's just the gestation of the mouse, 3 weeks. And it was so efficient that people are using that routinely to do anything. And that sparked then the idea, should we use this in humans? Well, and that comes a whole debate. Should one do this in human? Why or why not?
Right. So CRISPR isn't just called CRISPR because it sounds so nice and crunchy. It actually stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats.
Okay. That is a mouthful of crunchy crisps. What's your favorite bag of crisps?
No, I'm not that. I'm not that British yet. Like,
no?
I'm not like a big crisp eater.
Okay.
They have like something called shrimp cocktail, which I see around a lot, like on the bus, like
as a flavor.
Kids. Yeah. It's okay.
They've definitely cloned that flavor from some poor shrimp.
Okay, I've lost it here. Obviously, in science, everything builds on something that came before it. So there are a lot of people that can be credited with some kind of involvement in it. But the main names in the game today are Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, George Church, and Feng Zhang, who collectively discovered in 2012 that the CRISPR system could be used as a cut-and-paste tool to modify genomes. Doudna and Charpentier received the Nobel Prize in 2020 for the development of a method for genome editing.
And so, Ava, do you remember the CRISPR scandal from a few years ago?
Yeah, you mean with the Chinese twins?
Yes, a Chinese scientist called Hui Jianqi told the Associated Press in 2018 that he had altered the genomes of twin baby girls, Lulu and Nana. And his intention was to make their cells resistant to infection by HIV when they would grow up in the future. So he told the Associated Press that he had altered the embryos of 7 couples during their fertility treatment, and that in each case, the father was HIV positive and the mother was negative. And what he did was he deleted a region of a receptor called CCR5 on the surface of the white blood cells, which sometimes occurs naturally as a rare natural genetic variation. And this would make it more difficult for HIV to infect those white blood cells. Now, it should be stated that none of the embryos were infected with HIV, you know, in this process. But he claimed that what he wanted to do was that to protect the babies, you know, from possible infection later on at some point in their lives.
And there was a big outrage about this, especially from within the scientific community, it seemed.
There was, because, you know, for one, Hui altered the genome in early stage embryos, and that change would affect the sperm and eggs of the embryos and make it hereditary thereafter, you know, if they had children themselves. And that's barred in most parts of the world. And there are other studies that have used CRISPR and CCR5, that's, you know, the genetic spot that cripples HIV infection, like I just said earlier. But they are used on patients that already have HIV and they gene edit so-called somatic cells. So the change would not be passed on to the patient's offspring.
Somatic cells are non-reproductive cells.
Yes. But mainly, you know, scientists generally responded to the experiment by saying it was like premature. Anthony Fauci, who at the time nobody really knew who he was, as, you know, we've all gotten to know Fauci because of the 2020 pandemic, he became a household name. Well, back just before then, in 2019, he responded to Hui's experiment as follows, and I quote, "The underlying purpose of doing this experiment was obviously to show that they could do gene editing on an embryo, but the purpose for the party involved does not make any sense. There are so many ways to adequately, efficiently, and definitively to protect yourself against HIV. The thought of editing the genes of an embryo to get to an effect that you could easily do in so many other ways is unethical."
Right, because the twins weren't necessarily ever going to contract HIV.
Yes. And lastly, because gene editing is just still so experimental, off-target mutations can easily occur. And potentially, you know, the gene edit could cause health problems later in life for these embryos. For example, the CCR5 gene isn't solely a receptor for HIV. It also has other functions, some of which, you know, we might not even know what they would be, you know. But what we do know is that it does play a part in memory, and there is research being done on CCR5's links to Alzheimer's, for example. It should also be said that Hui's experiment still remains very mysterious to this day because, you know, he hasn't published any transparent or definitive scientific data about this whole affair. In the end, he was actually fined a hefty sum and sentenced to 3 years in jail.
So this is obviously a huge ethical issue also, which we haven't really talked about yet. Are we allowed to optimize our genes? Sure, it seems great if you can save someone from developing a terrible disease and if you can ease suffering. But my next thought is this technology will likely be accessed the most by the rich or the privileged, at first at least. What would that lead to? What would the average wealthy person use CRISPR for?
Yeah, well, I guess they'll probably use it to eliminate things like cancer genes or any diseases, hereditary diseases that they know they might have.
At some point, I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but you might be able to alter the gene responsible for aging or somehow access the fountain of youth, essentially.
Yeah, it always does end up there, doesn't it? Immortality.
Yeah, maybe that's just my mind, though. No, but seriously, one thing I've noticed from speaking with scientists is that in general, they genuinely want to make the world a better place. Like, they want to help people, cure people, somehow make life better for people. Whereas what ends up happening is that people who are driven by profit then seem to chime in and commercialize said innovation. I'm not saying that scientists aren't driven by money, you know, I'm generalizing, but that's just where things always seem to take a wrong turn.
Yeah, I mean, this we've seen this before, right? Like, it's always that science needs to pay, quote unquote, pay for itself, and so therefore make money, not just be a source of, you know, good.
Maybe we should save that for a special episode.
Yes, we can, like, have a deep dive into what, yeah. Yes, we should have a special episode. But tell me, what did Janusz think about the Chinese CRISPR twins?
Yeah, I asked him that.
To my opinion, there's no real application in humans. But because, I mean, I can go through the arguments.
Yeah,
there is really, I mean, you can, what people think they could eliminate bad disease genes, such as Huntington's, which is a dominant disease, a terrible disease. You just correct the gene. And there are various reasons why I think that doesn't make sense. One is, first of all, you can make pre-implantation diagnosis. You can take a biopsy of an embryo before you implant the embryo and figure out whether 50% of the embryos are normal.
Mm-hmm.
50% are mutants, a dominant disease. And you don't implant embryos which have the mutation. Very straightforward, it works. So you don't need correction. Right? And so there are many other ways. There are many also scientific issues of why this is problematic. So we don't necessarily need that. You can ask the question, should you do it for eliminating a gene? For example, what was done now in China, the HIV mm-hmm. receptor. I find, so first of all, this experiment was totally unacceptable. But there's no good rationale for that. And the reason is the following, several. Scientifically, this receptor, when you delete it, makes you more susceptible to other diseases.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So these children, if it was worked, they're at risk for getting other viral infections, much, much more serious, or even getting multiple sclerosis with a higher incidence. As all the data are there.
Oh.
So this receptor has other functions mm-hmm. except transporting HIV.
Oh, I see.
I think
okay.
That's one thing which. So then you come to this, if you make a human who is resistant to a disease, you could call this enhancement. It's not a treatment. It's no medical need. Enhancement. Or you can ask the question, is that the right thing to do? But more importantly, you don't need it in embryos. You can do it somatically. People have now AIDS patients take the bone marrow out, inactivate the receptor, put the bone marrow cells back, and they're resistant to HIV. They're cured. But, so you don't need that, right?
But are they then also more susceptible to...
No, it's only in the bone marrow.
Okay, okay.
Right? So, and then, of course, this you can... First of all, the patient can give the consent wanted, right? And you can look at this. I mean, you can then react yourself. So these viruses likely infect other cells. I don't know exactly. There might or may not be receptive, but that's not having AIDS, I think that's... These babies, they may never get infected with AIDS. So I think it's an outrageous experiment, to my opinion. It was not, and it will have, I think, major repercussions for the field. So I don't see, particularly since you can do it somatically, treat these diseases. There's no need for doing this in embryos. It's not clear exactly how this experiment was done. And implant these embryos without really analyzing it before is unacceptable. Having no babies. But anyway, that's, I think, is of concern. And you can make enhancement. You can ask the question, can you make human beings who are taller or more intelligent?
Designer babies.
And so intelligence or something is so complex, no way. It's just beyond what we can do. Taller, you could, but do you want that? So that's not a scientific issue. It's an ethical issue, right? Mm-hmm. So do we want that or do we don't want that?
And you would say you don't want that?
No, I would have certainly quite a lot of reservations. You just can read Huxley's Brave New World and you get exactly what he envisioned 100 years ago. And that, indeed, you could imagine doing this with animals. They can do this. For example, a very useful application would be to change mosquitoes in a way that they become resistant to malaria.
Oh.
And then these strains would take over and compete well with the other, with the wild-type mosquitoes. So you don't kill the mosquitoes, but you make them, they don't propagate the malaria anymore. So that's useful, right?
Yes.
So you could argue, and probably for this type of application will be a lot in agriculture, in biomedical research, which we're doing. You can make mutants of anything. You can make mutants now in monkeys. Before you couldn't do that. It's rather efficient because it's so efficient, this whole thing. Mice, we make it daily, these mutations in mice. So it's a very useful, very exciting technology. And I would always think you cannot prevent people doing experiments to get new knowledge. It doesn't make sense. But if it's application to humans, that needs to be discussed and regulated. Society should say, we want it or we don't want this. I think that's where it is. So this becomes not a scientific issue anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's this experiment now raises exactly that question.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we? Do we want that or do we not want this? Some societies may say, sure, let's do it. And others may say, no, we don't want that. So that's really up to this public discussion.
So he's basically saying it's up to science to innovate and develop new technologies and research, and then it's up to the public to decide what to do with it.
Yeah, and I think like right now, in kind of the general public's mind, CRISPR is much more palatable than like full-on cloning a human.
It does seem less far-fetched, but I wonder if that's because we're just not far enough into the future of it yet. In 30 years, cloning might seem about as crazy as CRISPR does to us now. I asked Janusz how he imagined that future.
And so do you, with cloning humans, what kind of future do you imagine for that? Or what would you hope?
None. So the reason is scientific, first of all, because most clones are not normal. So it's called epigenetic abnormality. We have looked at this very carefully. So most clones, I think I would argue all clones are not normal, but some are less abnormal than others. And the less abnormal ones survive. But they might have that might have some problems, right? So that's not totally established. So there's really no good application for cloning of humans. That's just for science fiction, I think. For animal, for agriculture, yes. People do this, and that's people think that's a good thing to use, and it is going on. I have no problem with that, obviously, to keep the same gene combination in an animal, which is useful for some reason. People use it for cloning their Struppi, their little dog, right? And well, if the company's doing this, well, it's not my kettle of beer.
I'm jumping in here to clarify that last sentence in case you couldn't hear properly. Janisch says people use it for cloning their dog Struppi. Struppi is sort of the go-to generic dog name in Germany, like Buddy might be in English.
Oh, good, because I thought like Struppi was some kind of new mutant animal.
No. It's just like, you know, any old dog.
Okay.
Janisch is German. Okay, back to the interview.
And what has been successfully cloned so far? Which animals
well, Dolly was a sheep, and then basically probably 15 different species. So mice, well, we worked a lot with mice, rats, cows, goats, cats, dogs, and even monkeys. So it really works.
Okay.
It's not efficient. It's very inefficient. So only a few percent succeed.
And what happens to the unsuccessful ones? They die?
Yeah, they die. Or? They die at various stages of development or right after birth. So they have defects. So the clones in general have what we call epigenetic defects. Not everything is correctly reset. They have certain, you see them, they're in general much bigger. It's called the large offspring syndrome. So you see.
Oh, they are bigger.
They're bigger, yeah. They're because
in size.
Edema and whatever. So they're just not normal. So we know what type of genes are affected. So that's so only a few are not normal enough to make it to adulthood.
Okay. And what happened? Do you ever have to terminate the life of a clone?
Yeah. If it's so Dolly had to be killed because she was too sick at 6 years of age. And so many mice just die in a week after birth or so, clones. Mm-hmm. Some survive. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, the life of clones is pretty bleak. Dolly suffered health issues. She developed arthritis quite early and was eventually euthanized at age 6 due to an incurable lung tumor. Incredibly, the Roslin Institute, the place that cloned Dolly, states on their website that they don't clone animals any longer due to the low success rate of cloning. They go on to state that Dolly was the only animal born from 277 cloned embryos.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot. It's funny, you know, Viagen somehow forget to mention all of this in their promotional video.
Wait, in Dorit Museev's call with you, remember when she said...
And then we had two false starts.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's what that's referring to.
So, hold on. I feel like I'm only now really starting to see the brutal side of this. So, fine, you use the nuclear transfer, the cloned embryo is growing, but then the surrogate mother, I assume, has to go through hormone therapy to prepare herself to accept the embryo, which we all know is a potentially harrowing process. Then she has a high chance of miscarrying. But let's say the pregnancy carries on. She still has to go through pregnancy itself, has to give birth. I mean, that's torture. Like, imagine a forced pregnancy. And yeah, of course, the cynic in me immediately thinks of Roe v. Wade being overturned. But this isn't about abortion rights. This is deliberately implanting an animal with an embryo and forcing them to go through a pregnancy. And I know we're talking about animals and not humans, but... I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, and I also what struck me listening back to your conversation with Janisch was when he mentioned that, you know, cloning is used in agriculture all the time. And, you know, it made me ask, you know, what is he referring to exactly?
Right. I at least was not aware of this.
Ava, are we like eating clones?
Oh my gosh. This makes me realize actually cloning doesn't have much to do with humans yet, at least. This is really an animal rights issue.
Dun, dun, dun. Yes. Should we...
Like a cliffhanger
sound? Yeah, let's just stop it there. We're eating clones. Attack of the Clones.
We'll continue this in our next episode, part two of the cloning saga, titled I Cloned My Cow, I Cloned My Cow. See what we did there? Thanks for listening, and thanks to our guests, Dorit Museev and Professor Rudolf Janisch.
This episode was written and produced by Ava Kelly, with additional writing by myself, John Holton.
Sound editing and design by David Magnusson.
Mundi Vundi is our executive producer, and he's also created the artwork for this episode in collaboration with Midjourney.
Additional research, script supervision, and fact-checking by Savita Joshi.
Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and on Twitter. And subscribe to the podcast if you don't already do so.
And please reach out if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you.